All right, I invite you to turn to Job chapter 40 and jump back into this incredible section of this incredible book that we've been studying. I think it's helpful, at least I find it to be helpful and even needful, to maintain a pretty comprehensive awareness and sort of grasp on the overall flow of this narrative, and in particular, the position, the posture, the statements, the acknowledgments, the confessions, the laments, the cries of Job, as we are in this section now, this climactic section in which the Lord is responding to him directly and specifically. In and through all these ups and downs where we've witnessed his personal grief and his physical anguish, his theological confusion, profound theological confusion, and really not even sensing the presence of God, Job has cried out to God in what you might just say distinctive ways, ways that you could maybe break down into various categories. We've heard him cry out to the Lord in despair and out of frustration, visceral frustration with the Lord. Job chapter 7, Job laments the brevity and the misery of his life. He desires to die. He's cursing the day that he is born. He says in Job chapter 7, "Remember that my life is a breath. My eye will never see good, again see good. What is man that you make so much of him and that you set your heart on him? Why do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I shall lie in the earth. You will seek me, but I shall not be." He has bitterness. He even sees God as oppressing him and condemning him in Job chapter 10. He's questioning why God even brought him to life, only to bring affliction. He says, "I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend against me. Does it seem good to you to oppress, to despise the work of your hands? You have granted me life and steadfast love. Why did you bring me out from the womb? Would that I had died before an eye had seen me." Job declares that God has in some way put him in the wrong and surrounded him with this affliction, and he's crying out for pity, and he's feeling isolated and in his suffering. We see him crying out in Job chapter 19, "Know then that God has put me in the wrong and closed his net about me. Behold, I cry out violence, but I am not answered. I call for help, but there is no justice. Have mercy on me. Have mercy on me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has touched me." He's expressing profound anguish. He's really accusing God of ignoring his cries. He's calling out for help in these cruel words that are coming at him, and he feels his death is imminent. In Job chapter 30, he says, "And now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me. I cry to you for help, and you do not answer me. I stand, and you only look at me. You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me." This is Job expressing to the Lord directly these cries of anguish and really frustration. He has also, in the midst of all that we've seen and actually been refreshed by, thankfully, these expressions of hope and trust in the midst of this suffering. In Job chapter 13, even in the face of what seems like imminent death, he affirms his hope in God and his readiness to defend his integrity before him. He says, "Though he slay me, I will hope in him. Yet I will argue my ways to his face. This will be my salvation, that the godless shall not come before him. Behold, I have prepared my case. I know that I shall be in the right." Later on in Job chapter 14, he wishes that God would hide him until his wrath is past, cover him in some way, and that the Lord would be his salvation, defend his integrity. In Job chapter 14, he says, "Oh, that you would hide me in Sheol, that you would conceal me until your wrath be past, that you would appoint me a set time and remember me. If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my service I would wait till my renewal should come. You would call and I would answer you. You would long for the work of your hands." Job appeals to even a heavenly witness in Job chapter 16, this witness in heaven to argue his case before God on his behalf. In Job chapter 16, he says, "O earth, cover not my blood, and let my cry find no resting place. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and he who testifies for me is on high. My friends scorn me. My eye pours out tears to God that he would argue the case of a man with God as a son of man does with his neighbor." And then amid deep despair, he ultimately, in this beautiful passage in Job chapter 19, he declares his confidence in this living Redeemer and this anticipation that he will have this vision of God, and he has this yearning for salvation. He says, "Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold and not another. My heart faints within me." So we see this mixture of anguish and frustration, even irritation with God and his seeming silence and his seeming absence in the midst of his unbearable despair and pain and anguish and grief. And then it's mixed with these glimmers of hope and clinging to some future day, some future redemption that can only be accomplished by God alone. And he's fighting to hold on to that kind of faith and hope. And then certainly, we saw no shortage of these pleas for a hearing, for justice to be served, for him to have his day in court, so to speak. We see this in Job chapter 13. We see it again in Job chapter 17, in Job chapter 23. And then the concluding sort of monologue of Job in Job chapter 31 that we've read before, where he finally says, "Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder. I would bind it like a crown to me. I would give him an account of all my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him." In that final monologue in Job chapter 31, he's calling for a hearing, a trial, a case before the Lord so that he can defend himself and plead his innocence. And in this final climactic section that begins in chapter 38 and continues all the way through verse 42, of course, we've already begun to see that the Lord God Almighty himself, creator of heaven and earth and all the inhabitants within it, the sustainer of heaven and earth, he makes his dramatic appearance in this fearsome and foreboding storm, and he begins to answer Job from the whirlwind, as the text tells us. And we notice that in all of his cries and in all of his laments and all of his appeals to God, Job fundamentally was questioning the presence of God in all of this. Really, he was questioning whether God was even aware or mindful of his suffering. That was Job's experience. That was Job's sense of things at various times through this trial. God, are you even there? Do you even know what's happening here? Are you even mindful or aware of the extent of my suffering? He would say, "I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth." But he would also say, "Does he even know what I'm going through? Is he even remotely aware of the suffering and pain that I'm experiencing?" And of course, as the Lord makes this dramatic appearance, he immediately begins to interrogate Job. And it's through this initial divine audience, as we've called it, that this high king of heaven and earth, he begins to answer Job's questions about his eternal presence and about his intimate awareness of Job's plight. Remember, we talked about this before. When the Lord begins to speak to Job, he doesn't begin to answer Job's questions of why he is suffering. You know, what was going on in heaven when Satan showed up? Can you give me a little insight there? Can you explain to me why my friends have abandoned me and betrayed me and made all these false accusations against me? I'd love to know the reasons for that. That's not what the Lord did with Job. Rather, he answered the more fundamental question about the presence of the Lord, even in the midst of our suffering, the awareness of the Lord in the midst of our trials. In chapter 38, verse 4, he does this by beginning with this question: where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? You're talking about presence. You're asking about where I've been. Let me ask you where you were. And then he begins to articulate all these characteristics of his presence and prerogative and power in his creation. He makes it overwhelmingly clear to Job that his eternal power and his uninterrupted presence and even his intimate knowledge are about to be on full and, I would say, formidable display before Job. You have questions about my power. You have questions about my presence. You have questions about my awareness. Let me show you. Let me show you my presence. Let me explain to you the extent and the depths of it. My knowledge and my awareness. Let me put it on display for you. And of course, he does that first by giving this exhibition of what we call the mysterious grandeur of inanimate creation, the depths and foundations of the earth, the boundaries of the seas, the command of the days, the origins of light and darkness, the purposeful control of all atmospheric conditions, the governance of celestial bodies, just on and on and on he goes. You want to talk about presence? I was there. I created these things. I control these things. At this macro scale, this grand scale of the heavens and the depths of the earth and the weather and all these celestial bodies that he controls, he gives them this vision of his presence even in those places where your mind can't even get to, much less your physical presence. And then he drops down to a more close view, to a more observable micro level of earthbound creatures. And he begins to speak of his meticulous management of animate creation. He speaks of the provision of sustenance for the fierce predator and the lowly scavenger, the unaided life cycles of untamed creatures, the enviable freedom of the wild donkey, the unsubdued strength of the wild ox, the purposeful absurdity of the ostrich, the majestic fearlessness of the warhorse, the winged dominance of birds of prey. Through this first round of the Lord's interrogation, the Lord Almighty, the eternal creator and sustainer of heaven and earth, is saying, Job, you're not sure I'm present in your suffering? You're not sure I'm aware of your trials? Chapter 40, verse 2, shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty, he says? He who argues with God, let him answer it. And then, of course, Job makes his initial, what we call a discerning acknowledgement, when he says in Job chapter 40, verses 3 to 5, then Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am of small account. Good call, Job. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once and I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further. In other words, I've got nothing. Nothing to say, nothing to offer, no answer to give. And then last week we turned our attention in the text to the second sort of round of this divine audience, the second round of the Lord's interrogation of Job. It's this decisive round. It's a round in which there's a shift. We called it the decisive authority in chapter 40, verse 6, all the way through 41, verse 34. There is this clear shift where he's moving toward a decisive conclusion of the matter with Job. And we noted last time that in the previous section, the Lord is demonstrating his unequivocal command and rule over the created order. But in this next section that we began to discuss last week, he's showing up and demonstrating and putting on display his singular and sovereign rule over the moral order. Job was questioning God's presence and awareness, but he was also, you remember, questioning God's morality in a sense. By questioning God's justice, by crying out that he needs a hearing, he needs to be vindicated, he's calling into question the justice of God, which is really a question on a cosmic morality level. Now, Job didn't know that. But that's what he's going to be instructed in this next round. Is there justice in God's world under his rule and authority, he's asking. Maybe he's even saying at his weakest moments, how could there be given my situation? How could there be justice given my current trial? He's calling God's moral order, God's rule of the moral order of his creation into question. And as we noted last week for Job's friends, is there justice in the world? They would say, yes, absolutely. And Job, you're the example. God is just. He's punishing you for some sin that you will not confess to. And regardless of our repeated efforts, regardless of us deploying all that we know in this matter, all that we can ascertain from the world around us and from our breadth and depth of knowledge, we have not been able to convince you of this, but justice there is, and you're the example of it, because God is punishing you in his justice because of your sin. Simple. Of course, this doesn't add up for Job, as we know, because Job knows that he's not guilty of the sin, the type of sin, the extent of sin that would warrant this kind of justice. Remember this retributive justice where God metes out his punishment according to the extent or nature of someone's wickedness. It's proportional and it's in time with someone's wickedness. And he's like, I don't deserve this. There's no way that this adds up in Job's mind. This doesn't add up to Job, but the Lord begins to question Job again in chapter 40, verses 8 to 9. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right? Have you an arm like God? Can you thunder with a voice like his? This is the Lord beginning to expose the depth and breadth of Job's case that he wants to bring before the Lord. This is the Lord saying, you think that you're just pleading your own case. You think that you're just calling into question the justice of your individual situation. But what you are doing is calling into question the justice, the moral integrity of the ultimate eternal judge and his created order and his moral order. That's why he begins this second round with this kind of question. Will you put me in the wrong? Have you an arm like God? Can you thunder with a voice like his? By questioning the purposes of God in the midst of his suffering, Job was actually, and as we've already alluded to, he's probably unwittingly questioning God's decisive authority, his prerogatives, his rule of his world and his moral order. And then in chapter 40, verses 10 to 14, the Lord, in a profoundly devastating way, calls upon Job, if Job is so inclined, to assume the seat of ultimate justice, in which the judge is also the executioner. Job, you think you understand justice? You think you know what just punishment for sin looks like? How it is to be affected, when it is to be affected, upon whom it is to be affected. You think you know this? If you are so inclined, assume that seat. He lays that out before him in chapters 10 to 14. And today we continue this exploration of this final interrogation in which this decisive authority over the created moral order is being illustrated. And it's illustrated for us, as he continues on, through the description of these two creatures. Creatures of immense size and power and unmatched ferocity. Creatures the Lord refers to here as Behemoth and Leviathan. Again, in chapter 40, verse 9, he says, Job, have you an arm like God? Can you thunder with a voice like his? And then verses 10 to 13, he says, are you able to adorn yourself with majesty and dignity and clothe yourself with glory and splendor such that you can stand above the proud and the wicked sinner and trample him under your feet in your righteous anger? Are you capable of that? Is that the seat that you want to sit in? Do you think that you can fathom the magnitude of such an assignment, Job? Are you that magnificent? Are you that mighty? Are you that dreadful and fierce? Before you answer, Job, chapter 40, verse 15, behold Behemoth. He continues, behold Behemoth, which I made as I made you. He eats grass like an ox. Behold his strength in his loins, and his power in the muscles of his belly. He makes his tail stiff like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze, his limbs like bars of iron. He is the first of the works of God. Let him who made him bring near his sword. For the mountains yield food for him where all the wild beasts play. Under the lotus plants he lies, in the shelter of the reeds and in the marsh. For his shade the lotus trees cover him. The willows of the brook surround him. Behold, if the river is turbulent, he is not frightened. He is confident though Jordan rushes against his mouth. Can one take him by his eyes or pierce his nose with a snare? Or what about this? Can you draw out Leviathan with a fishhook or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many pleas to you? Will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you to take him for your servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird, or will you put him on a leash for your girls? Will traders bargain over him? Will they divide him up among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hands on him. Remember the battle. You will not do it again. Behold, the hope of a man is false. He is laid low even at the sight of him. No one is so fierce that he dares to stir him up. Who then is he who can stand before me? Who has first given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. I will not keep silence concerning his limbs or his mighty strength or his goodly frame. Who can strip off his outer garment? Who would come near him with the bridle? Who can open the doors of his face? Around his teeth is terror. His back is made of rows of shields, shut up closely as with a seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They clasp each other and cannot be separated. His sneezings flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the dawn. Out of his mouth go flaming torches. Sparks of fire leap forth. Out of his nostrils comes forth smoke, as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame comes forth from his mouth. In his neck abides strength, and terror dances before him. The folds of his flesh stick together, firmly cast on him and immovable. His heart is hard as a stone, hard as the lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid. At the crashing, they are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches him, it does not avail, nor the spear, the dart, or the javelin. He counts iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee from him, for him. Sling stones are turned to stubble. Clubs are counted as stubble. He laughs at the rattle of javelins. His underparts are like sharp potsherds. He spreads himself like a threshing sledge on the mire. He makes the deep boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. Behind him he leaves a shining wake. One would think the deep to be white-haired. On earth there is not his like, a creature without fear. He sees everything that is high. He is king over all the sons of pride. This is decisive authority that the Lord is articulating to Job. Decisive authority over the moral order, illustrated through the description of these two massive and imposing creatures. Job, can you compare yourself to Behemoth, the mightiest of all land creatures? Can you compare yourself to Leviathan, the fiercest and most dreaded of all sea creatures? As I'm sure you can well imagine, there's a fair amount of debate concerning the nature and identity of these creatures. These two magnificently described creatures here in this text, are these mythical or legendary creatures that are being described here? Are they creatures that are described in vivid and poetic language, and really they just serve as metaphors, as illustrative metaphors of the sort of the power of God and the authority of God. Is that what we're dealing with here? This is certainly the case in much Jewish rabbinic tradition and extra-biblical literature. References to Behemoth, depicted as the male primeval land monster. And then there's a counterpart, this female sea monster, Leviathan. Both are separated at creation, and to prevent them from overwhelming the world, they are reserved for a future eschatological banquet for the righteous in the Messianic age. So you've got this Jewish tradition and extra-biblical rabbinic literature that would point to them as sort of mythological creatures. They have some kind of end-time sort of corollary or representation, but they're not actual physical creatures on the earth. Several examples could be pointed to in extra-biblical literature that references these creatures from a Jewish rabbinic tradition. And then, of course, Leviathan, this dragon-like sea creature, has reference points in both legendary stories and also even in descriptive eyewitness accounts that don't bear the mark of mythic language at all, that run throughout history and around the world, actually. China has the most numerous and detailed, what you might say, non-mythological accounts, where dragons, as they would be identified, were seen as real, destructive, often tied to weather events like storms. These creatures actually appear in imperial histories and in court records, in local news outlets, if you will. And in those writings, they're treated as factual observations by people. And of course, medieval and ancient European sources often treated dragon, descriptive creatures like dragons as real animals. In chronicles and in traveler reports, it'd be like reading someone who's just journaling, and they might be talking about, you know, the tavern that they just stopped at the previous town, and then they're on their way again, and then they have this encounter with this incredible creature. In other words, it's sort of pedantic, mundane language that then all of a sudden they're describing this encounter, this sighting. Now, I guess if my little sort of fictional anecdote were true and they were coming from a tavern, maybe they weren't really seeing it after all. I don't know. But but the fact of the matter is that the nature of the literature, the nature of the writing is sort of like chronicling something. So you have this body of mythic sort of legendary literature, and you've seen the movies and read the books, right? Fantasy novels and all that kind of thing. But there is lots of literature that is not written as though it is legend or myth. You have references of that, as I said, in lots of them in China and medieval ancient Europe, India and Persia. Ancient accounts describe large serpents as real threats. Sometimes they're described in these travel or conquest narratives that have been written. In Africa, and specifically Ethiopia, you have these classical sources, like reputable classical sources that mention dragons hunting elephants. And these sources are treating these accounts like natural history. They're not treating it like some kind of fanciful story. To stop and think about this for a minute, I need to point you back to some things we talked about before when we were looking at this first section in which the Lord was pointing to his works in creation and setting the foundations of the earth and knowing the beginning point of light and the ending point of darkness and commanding the day and all these things that the Lord has control over and creative power over. And I gave you some examples of all the things that we don't know, that science doesn't know. We need to be reminded of this important principle. We are living in an era in which the air that we breathe is an air that feeds human hubris. The operating principle regarding knowledge is that which we don't know, we will know. It's just a matter of time. In a scientific world where the scientific mind has become the predominant mode of thinking, the assumption is that we know a lot more than we do, and that things like this, descriptions like this, creatures like this, have to be confined to the annals of myth and legend. That's not real. In fact, what we want to do is we even want to try to explain away, even if we want to try to equate these kinds of descriptions with something real that we can put our hands on, that we can get our minds around. We much prefer that. Why? Because we're proud. We're full of hubris. The world hasn't always been like that. And let me remind you that scientific estimates indicate that we've only mapped 5% or less of the ocean floor. That there's far more in this world and in this cosmos and in the seas that surround the land. There's far more that we have no idea about than what we do know. Far more. And yet we operate with a mindset that there is no mystery. You go to the pages of Scripture, and even as it points to future days, you have descriptions of creatures and things that are astounding, that don't fit within our scientific frame at all. You have visions that are recorded on the pages of Scripture where the veil of this earthly existence is sort of pulled away and the glories of heaven are revealed, and you're given this description of creatures that are just astounding and don't resemble anything in our sphere of experience. None whatsoever. Even in recorded paleontological history, you have numerous occasions in which there are species that were deemed extinct for hundreds of years until another example of that species was discovered again. We just don't know a lot. And you come to references like this and you're like, well, that was just poetic, or that was just exaggeration, or that was just using language to kind of stir up the reader. Well, let's look at some of the biblical references to Leviathan. By the way, I prepared two lessons thinking I was preparing one, so we'll have to take this in 2 weeks. Psalm 74, for example, verses 10 to 14. By the way, the references to Behemoth are very, very narrow. The references to Leviathan, both in Scripture and then broadly, as I've already indicated, are much more significant. The Psalm 74, verses 10 to 14, sort of a lament in the face of judgment. How long, O God, is the foe to scoff? Is the enemy to revile your name forever? Why do you hold back your hand, your right hand? Take it from the fold of your garment and destroy them. Yet God, my King, is from old, working salvation in the midst of the earth. You divided the sea by your might. You broke the heads of the sea monsters on the waters. You crushed the heads of Leviathan. You gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness. Now, this is obviously poetic. This is a psalm. But the context is not indicating a description of a mythical figure here. Psalm 104, 24 to 27. O Lord, how manifold are your works! In wisdom, you have made them all. Speaking of the works of God in creation. The earth is full of your creatures. Psalm 104, verse 25. Here is the sea, great and wide, which teems with creatures innumerable. That's the mindset of someone who is appropriately humble about what might be in the depths of the sea. Here is the sea, great and wide, which teems with creatures innumerable. Living things, both small and great. There go the ships and Leviathan, which you formed to play in it. These all look to you to give them their food in due season. And then in Isaiah chapter 27, verses 1 to 4. This is a speaking of an ultimate future deliverance and restoration, a deliverance from judgment. This is pointing to a future day. If you back up into Isaiah, you'll see the context there, where there's judgment and destruction, and then there's hope for a future restoration at the Lord's hand. It says, "In that day, the Lord, with his hard and great and strong sword, will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, the twisting serpent, and he will slay the dragon that is in the sea." And this is using what you might refer to as symbolic language to speak about the Lord's destruction of a being that is associated with wickedness and chaos and destruction. An adversarial being he's describing here, but he's giving it the name Leviathan, this representative name of this creature that is known for its fierceness and its characteristics of a twisting serpent and a dragon-like description. And then, of course, you go back in Job chapter 3, verse 8, really not verse 8, starting in verse 3. This is the first monologue, if you will, of Job after his three friends come to visit him and sit with him for 7 days in silence as they mourn with him and his suffering. And then Job begins to speak, and he is just cursing the day of his birth. He is lamenting in anguish. And in verse 3 of chapter 3, he says, "Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said, 'A man is conceived.' Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan." He is layering upon layer. He's layering these ideas or these pictures of how much he wishes the day of his birth never happened. All these different images, let it just be disappeared. And here at the end, let those who curse the day, those who have the capacity to rouse up Leviathan, let them rouse up Leviathan. John Hartley says it this way. He says, "To ensure the vitality of his curse, Job importunes the most skilled sorcerers in the ancient world to perform the curse against the day of his birth. These sorcerers are known as those prepared to stir up Leviathan, the monster that inhabits the sea and that is the personification of all forces that resist God's rule. Leviathan continually seeks to turn beauty into dust and order into confusion." So in Scripture, you actually see what I would just call a blended description. Actual sea-dwelling creature in this Leviathan that is massive and ferocious. But it also serves as a representation or this embodiment of chaos and rebellion and destruction, who will one day be crushed by the Lord. So what about in our text? What are we seeing in our text with all these descriptions? Are Behemoth and Leviathan actual creatures with which Job and his contemporaries would be familiar in some way? Well, if we come back to the text itself, I think that both the context and the actual language here in these descriptions compel us to answer yes. That what is being described here are not mythological creatures. In fact, the reason why I would say that is you have this panoply of actual created entities and creatures that have already been described in this immediate context. He's using his created world. And remember, this is the Lord speaking. This is a demonstration of the Lord's knowledge of his creation. And he's already described all of these entities and all of these animals and all of their habitat and all the ways that he provides for them and sustains them and feeds them and cares for them and all the ways that he describes their capabilities that he made possible. So the context is pointing to actual creatures in his created world that the Lord is describing. And then you get to the details themselves. These descriptive details regarding habitat and physical characteristics are very detailed. I mean, he's going to great lengths to describe these creatures in some meaningful detail. In fact, in more detail than he described any of the previous creatures that he's already spoken about. And then a final thought on this is that I would consider it a very ineffective use of mythological creatures to illustrate God's actual authority and power. There's a little bit of cognitive dissonance in that thought, right? I mean, this whole narrative, this whole section in which the Lord is speaking, he is trying to put Job in a right frame of mind about who the Lord is, about where the Lord is, about what the Lord can do, what the Lord has accomplished. And he's using his creative capacities that are unparalleled and unmatched, his actual work of creation, actual examples that can be pointed to, that Job can apprehend as he's describing them. And then suddenly, in the final concluding section, where he's sort of putting the final stamp on his whole sort of discussion with Job, and he's laying this down with decisive authority, he draws upon stories of myth and legend to describe his power and his authority. It just doesn't seem to work, in my estimation, as a compelling way to describe that. Another commentator says this: the identification of Behemoth and Leviathan is disputed, ranging from earthly creatures to mythical monsters. As earthly beasts, they are identified as the hippopotamus and the crocodile, respectively, which I will dispute. Realistic, detailed descriptions keep the portrait from becoming purely mythical. Nevertheless, into the factual description, the author skillfully blends fanciful metaphors drawn from mythic accounts of monsters in order that these beasts may represent both mighty terrestrial creatures and cosmic forces. In this way, Yahweh addresses the cosmic dimensions of Job's affliction. You have to remember, this began really in the courtroom or in the council room or the abode of God himself. This whole account began in a celestial realm that we don't have access to. And we know that there are rulers and principalities and spiritual forces at work all around us, that there are things going on that we can't see, and that runs not only into our physical world that we've already mentioned and alluded to, but also in the spiritual realm. And we know, if you go back to Genesis chapter 3, what was it that approached Eve in the garden? Named a serpent, right? When you go to Revelation, what is Satan referred to as? A dragon. So you have this correlation, or this blend, if you will, of actual creatures, descriptions of actual creatures that also have correlation or embodiment of cosmic things, of celestial beings and entities that seem to be at work here. I think that particularly plays in with Leviathan, which we will get to, and we are out of time. Man. Okay, so many, as I said, would contend that Behemoth and Leviathan are actual creatures, namely the hippopotamus and the crocodile. And there are problems with that in the text, for sure. And goodness, we're going to have to just stop. All right. So next week, we'll talk about sauropods and dreadnoughtus and other creatures that I know very little about. If you're like an armchair paleontologist, just keep quiet next week. All right. No one needs to hear from you. No, don't embarrass the teacher, please. But we'll try to kind of unpack some of this, and obviously the ultimate answer is we don't know exactly what these creatures were, but there are corollaries that we can point to that might be reasonable explanations that we can think about. Okay, we'll talk about that next week. Thank you for your time.